You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to the program. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John and Celeste this morning. Well, last week we gave you a little bit of news that studies show that teens are driving much, much less. Many of them not getting driver's licenses. Those that do, not bothering to get behind a wheel. Now, you guys have been lighting it up on this issue with responses on the website and on the phone. Last week, listener Emily, who is 25 and from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, weighed in on why young people had been buying fewer cars.
Financially, we couldn't afford a car, especially the gas. A lot of us at that age didn't have jobs yet, and the gas was just ridiculous.
Now, here's Jonathan from Cambridge in Massachusetts, says that his friends use mass transit instead, but for the comfort.
Just about everybody who doesn't have kids, who lives anywhere near a bus, isn't going to be driving if they don't have to, because it's a waste of time. That's time they could be spent on their smartphones.
Here's Cindy from Bedford, New Hampshire, who also called in.
It also depends so much on lifestyle and on where exactly you live. If you live in the suburbs, you need a car if you have a family. If you live in the city, not so much.
Now, I'm with these guys. I'm with Jonathan from Cambridge. I spend a lot of time on the bus in Washington. I do spend time on my smartphone, maybe not the best use of my time, but I do it nonetheless. I can work on the bus and get to work on Capitol Hill. But our next guest says that living in a city, at least in America, is not a panacea for the car-free lifestyle. For his new book, Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile, Terrace Gresco visited 12 cities around the world to take a closer look at the role of public transportation in our present lives and what it means for the future of urban planning, transportation, and our own quality of life. Terrace, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Now, you're in Toronto, right?
I am today.
Pretty good subway system in Toronto. I've spent a lot of time there. I used to live in Montreal. My sister lived in Toronto for years. You focused on 12 cities in your book. What are some examples of the best cities for mass transit, and what does it mean to be the best in this area?
I guess, you know, there are unbeatable cities in Asia, like Tokyo. There are 800-plus stations in a city, a megalopolis of 36 million people, which means you can go from anywhere to anywhere in that city via rail transit, often in comfort, unless you get stuck in the rush hour crush, of course. And you can mimic the anywhere-to-anywhere mobility of an automobile that exists in a lot of American cities because of the freeway network. A lot of Asian and European cities have this. Paris, for example, is building a 30 billion euro super metro, which is going to completely encircle the city, an automatic 24-hour system that will link all of the suburban rail lines with the existing metro in the center of the city and bring complete mobility to the suburbs. This is where a lot of cities in the industrialized world are at. And even cities like Bogota in Colombia have built bus rapid transit systems that are like subways on the street with fast loading on platforms.
Mm-hmm. Terrace, I like what you had to say there about Tokyo and Paris and Bogota, but mm-hmm. none of those cities is in my home of the United States. And it makes me need to ask you if anybody in America is measuring up to these three greatest cities for mass transit that you just mentioned.
I start the book in New York. New York is a city that actually saw its subway track mileage shrinking in the 20th century. Finally, they've done the math, and they're building the 7-line extension and the long-promised Second Avenue subway. Tunnel boring machines are at work under the pavement of Manhattan right now, and they're adding new track mileage, which is a great thing because 1.6 billion people are riding the New York subway every year now. That's a record since 1950, which in the post-war years were record years for transit in the United States. Los Angeles, the quintessential city of sprawl in many people's minds, there was a referendum. They gave themselves a half-cent sales tax in a time of recession to expand their existing subway system to build more light rail. Denver, Phoenix even, Salt Lake City have built light rail. It's happening all over the United States. People are doing the math. They realize that cars are in retreat. This is the first time that demotorization, the national automobile fleet, is actually decreasing.
Mm-hmm. And
at this point.
What about the, you know, there's a culture clash here for Americans, I think. When you talk about the national automotive fleet decreasing for the first time, we've all heard the legend of, you know, American freedom, American exploration, the Chevy, all the songs. We all know how inextricably cars are tied to the American identity. Can we be trusted to change that in a responsible way, do you think?
I just think it's happening on its own. When I grew up, the car was all about it. It was Jack Kerouac. It was On the Road. It was Bruce Springsteen songs. It was Get Out of Your Town. The automobile is freedom. The reality is the automobile isn't freedom very much when congestion is gripping every major city, when the car is used as the de facto mode of public transportation. You try to shoehorn it into metropolises of, you know, 4 or 5, 6 million people. It just doesn't work. And we've hit the wall. It costs the U.S. economy $115 billion a year in wasted time and gas just sitting in traffic. That has an impact on our lives. It also has impact on goods transport because trucks are paralyzed in that. Yeah. So if we don't start engineering our way out of what we've built, which is transportation systems built around freeways, and start building the kind of intelligent transportation they've been building in Europe and Asia for the last few decades, then we're in trouble.
Taras Gresko, I want to just end the conversation. We've got a minute left. On the issue of bikes, your native city of Montreal has bike sharing, which is bikes locked up. You pay a couple of bucks, you put in a card, you ride a bike wherever you want and lock it up somewhere else. It's the model for the bike sharing in my city of Washington, D.C. New York has it coming online in Chicago, other cities. But is bike sharing just a model for dense urban centers, or can it be brought to cities with more sprawl, like Denver, like Phoenix, that have much larger distances to cover?
It works best in more compact cities. That's where it's thriving right now. But it exists in 120 cities around the world. It's something that really helps you get to transit. It becomes part of the journey. I'll admit that it might be a stretch in a place like Phoenix or Atlanta.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly been a benefit in Washington, D.C. I'm a member, like to bike anywhere that I can. So maybe that's part of the equation. Now, that's Taras Gresko. He is author of the new book. Well, there's much more on Taras Gresko and his views over at Transportation Nation, our transportation partner, online and at thetakeaway.org and at transportationnation.org. Taras Gresko joining us from Toronto in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you.